Montreal, good evening. Tonight is one of those nights where you don't have to hear too much from me. We're doing a Three Wise Men evening. Reminds me of the story when Harry Truman became president and he told his press secretary, Charlie Ross, "Charlie, with all these fancy opinions up here, I need some Missouri around me right quick." And we're going to get some Missouri around us right quick tonight. There's been so much happening in this country between the Afghanistan debate, Karzai visit, the Arar inquiry, the liberal leadership race. We got to get some focus, and we're going to have some focus tonight from three extraordinary observers of the scene. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking to David Harris, former deputy director of planning for CSIS. We're going to have Ray Hurd discuss a political race that we're not paying too much attention on, but we really should, since a third of Canadians will be voting in it, and that's the Toronto mayoralty. But we're starting with a gentleman that I consider, and I'll let my personal prejudices go right in here, one of the most acute observers of the Canadian scene. He doesn't just write about politics, he writes about our national character. And we've been trying to get our schedules in place for about a week to talk about so much that he's written. If for no other reason for buying the Globe and Mail, buy it to reach John Ibbotson. John Ibbotson, thank you. We finally connected, and thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you, and thanks for the introduction.
John, I mean it sincerely. I started out talking to you about a week ago about the Karzai visit, the Arar inquiry, but I guess the papers are filled with the leadership contest, the Liberal leadership race, and you wrote in your column today something that was exactly on my mind. The headline was Ignatieff takes 30%, but as I looked at the numbers, Ray, Dion, Kennedy, that amounted to a healthy 55% center-left to left. It almost reminded me of the reverse of 1968 when you had Trudeau with almost the same percentage as Ignatieff on the center left to left, and everybody else from Robert Winters to Paul Hellyer to everybody else, center right to right. So as you put it so well, the headline in your column, which way is up?
Well, it's a good point. I think all of the all political parties have a grassroots membership that's that is to the right or the left, depending on the party, of the party mainstream. So that is to say, Liberals tend to be more left-wing than the Liberal Party in power. The NDP grassroots tend to be way more left-wing even than the NDP is. And on the right, this is true of Conservatives as well. So what you then have, and this is the essence of the hypocrisy of a leadership race, what you have during any leadership race is the...
I'd like to underline that for our listeners, the essence of hypocrisy.
You have...
Go ahead.
You have a mainstream... administration of the party, senior figures in the party, the powerful, the backroom boys, who know what they need to do in order to position their party in the next election to win. And they know that the one thing they can't do is allow the grassroots of the party to hijack the party and take it where the electorate as a whole doesn't want to go. But what you also have is the grassroots electing the leadership. So you always have this struggle between the institutions of the party and the populist sentiment within the party. And we're seeing that reflected right now. It's perfectly clear that Michael Ignatieff is the candidate of the center, and he's very much Paul Martin in his foreign policy, and even in his environmental policy as well. And the big boys like him. But 70% of the electorate, if you count all of them in, voted for candidates who are to the left of that, who want to pull us out of Afghanistan, who want to somehow keep to our Kyoto commitments, even though they're impossible. So that's the real dynamic inside the Liberal Party right now, how to keep the grassroots from hijacking the party, even though they have by far the majority of the votes available at the at the convention.
Is there not some wool being pulled over the eyes of not only the grassroots of the party, but of Canadians when we paint figures like Bob Rae as, quote, progressives, yet the people behind them are the full establishment? John Rae of Power Corp, Senator Leo Colbert. What's the difference between the two establishments?
Well, I think that's true. And what you've hit on, Beryl, is another thing that's going on in this campaign, because there's never just one thing going on in the campaign. Yes, a lot of the establishment is behind Michael Ignatieff. He has most of the caucus. He has a chunk of the former cabinet. He has people like Ian Davey, Keith Davey's son, running the campaign. He's got a lot of the establishment too. But there's another side of the establishment, especially over on the left, people like Lloyd Axworthy, for example, John Godfrey, the MP, who's very much a thinking MP in Toronto and is on the left, who deeply resent Ignatieff. They resent the fact that he was out of the country during all the years when they were fighting to save it. He wasn't here during Leech Lake. He wasn't here during Charlottetown, during the 95 referendum, during the Clarity Bill. And now he wants to sort of come back and polish off his resume by running a G7 country. And they aim to stop him. So there is, in fact, a split within the establishment and the institutions of the party as well between Ray and Ignatieff, and also a split along ideological lines.
We're going to take a short break here to pay some bills, and then we're going to come back and talk to you, John, about what's really good for the country and whether there is anything ideological or even liberal in this party left. Montreal, we'll be right back. And we're back, and we're talking to John Ibbotson, one of the finest observers of the scene in Canada, not only politically, but in terms of our national character. And John, it's our national character that I want to discuss for a second. Whatever one may think about the policies of Stephen Harper, and I'll admit to my prejudice for most of his policies, I don't like his justice bill. I think it's the same kind of anti-civil libertarian justice bill that we saw under Paul Martin. But you had in Stephen Harper and in that convention clear policies. I've been looking at this liberal leadership race, and as president of the Institute of Public Affairs, I've had three campaign managers come to me for assistance, and I said, forget about it. I'm not seeing any positions. I'm seeing candidates that jump all over the place. At least in 68, we knew where Trudeau stood. Yes, Ignatieff has certain policies that we knew him for, but I believe they've been watered down. Ray, I don't know where Ray stands. Dion is Mr. Environment, and Jerry Kennedy is going on his good looks. What is Canada? What should Canadians be looking for from these people?
I think part of it, by the way, just by way of prescription, rather than prescription, has to do with the times. We were living in pretty tumultuous times in 1968.
Yes.
Those of us who are old enough to remember it as probably being the most cataclysmic year after the Second World War. So you had a polarized debate. Now, the debate is not so polarized. Nobody wants deficits. And people want to keep taxes reasonably low. Social policy is more or less in consensus. Where the great divisions in the country right now occur are on foreign policy, which frankly I find extraordinary. I would never have thought 4 years ago that Canada would be torn apart over things like Afghanistan and Iraq.
But
and
John, do we really have a consensus on social policy? It's just a matter that Canadians are letting their individual liberties be sold off for $20 more in a government check. In 68, Trudeau defined himself on civil liberties. The state has no room in the bedrooms of the nation. Harper defined himself not so much on foreign policy as Canada's place in the world and being involved with our traditional allies. These are specific issues. What specific, if I had to say, okay, what does Ignatieff stand for or Ray, I wouldn't know. Yes, I knew the Ignatieff of who wrote The Lesser Evil, but I'm not hearing that today.
Well, I think you could say, and you're right, look, again,
except in muted tones.
In these leadership campaigns, everyone tries to crowd towards the center because nobody wants to say anything so divisive. But you would at least, in a debate between Ray and Ignatieff, and one of the crimes of this leadership race is that the debate format was such that you never actually got anything like that.
It was a joke.
In a debate between Ignatieff and Ray, what it would be about? It would be about, it wouldn't be on climate change. It wouldn't be on child care. It wouldn't be on any of that stuff. It would be on Ray wants to pull Canada out of Afghanistan, terminating our commitments to stay there until 2009. Ray is very much part of the multinational United Nations consensual approach to world affairs, whereas Ignatieff is much more tied to traditional alliances, the United States and Great Britain, and would keep us in Afghanistan and defended the invasion of Iraq, something that has him offside with much of the party. I think that's the only thing left in terms of huge divisive social issues, huge divisive issues. I don't think on health care and education, even on the fiscal imbalance, you're going to find broad disagreement among these candidates.
Bob Ray was quoted in the past 48 to 72 hours as saying that we've been talking in the first part of this leadership race to 180,000 people. Now, from now till December, we'll be talking to 5,000. Are we going to see, or does your gut tell you that we're going to see any kind of coalition where Ray, Dion, and Kennedy are going to be talking from the same script leading up to an anybody but Ignatieff move at the convention?
Well, if they do that, they have to decide, do they, in fact, stay all the way to the convention. I mean, the only way to stop Ignatieff now is for one of the other three to drop out and throw his support to one of the other two. But each is fatally flawed. Ray did very badly in Ontario. He only got 15% of the vote, and he was the premier of that province.
And Kennedy
only got 1% of the vote in Quebec. Dion did not well or not badly anywhere. So who is going to swallow his ego, torpedo his chances of ever becoming Prime Minister of Canada, and throw his support to one of the other two? Unless and until that happens, this remains Michael Ignatieff's to lose.
Final question. On Friday, I was furious at what the party did to Joe Volpe, not because I have any particular love for Volpe or anything else, but I know the way this party operates, and this was smears and drive-by accusations as if nothing ever happened in any other campaign. This man produced half the new delegates. Does that have any strength on the convention floor, even though, sorry, half the new members they signed up,
right,
though he did very poorly on delegates? Does that have any strength on the convention floor?
No. I think the party, they may have tried to do a hatchet job on Volpe on Friday, but on the other hand, they were far too soft on him earlier when it was discovered that he was signing up young children with convention with donation, $5,400 donation.
Well, yes, but that was two kids of Barry Sherman, one of the richest men in the country. Nobody's going to convince me that Volpe convinced Sherman to do that to his kids.
What matters is that the party is trying to shed its image, and it may be that it's not an image, of being far too fast and loose with the rules. And, of course,
that may not be
the sponsorship scandal in Quebec, and this party is dying in Quebec as a result. So,
well, John, but that part of the reason is that a Quebec realized that Gomery was a whitewash of Martin, who, after the election rules came in, was shown in pictures in your own paper as leaving the house of two multimillionaires at $5,000 head dinners.
No question that Martin might have gotten off easy on sponsorship, but what the Liberals have to do now is get sponsorship behind them, or they face collapse in the province of Quebec. So anytime Volpe or anyone else comes along with credible allegations against them of sleazy tricks,
right,
they try to torpedo him. And yes, they want Joe Volpe to go away. On the other hand, Joe Volpe claiming that it's all because people are prejudiced against him because he's Italian is ludicrous.
Well, I don't think it's because he's Italian, but I think, you know, Joe Volpe has never shared anything with the establishment. And meanwhile, the story of the 11 strange members of Etobicoke Lakeshore, Michael Ignatieff's own writing, has somehow been buried after being in the press for 20 seconds.
Be fair. That got looked at, and it was pretty torqued.
Yeah, some would say a lot of stuff about Volpe, but be that as it may, what you're saying is we're going to have one humdinger of a convention in Montreal.
Oh, whatever else it is, it's wonderful for pundits, because this is going to go out of this, unless one of the three other contenders drops out and throws his support to the other. This is going to the fourth ballot.
Well, John Ibbotson, there's one pundit that I constantly read, if this is fodder for your mill, then churn it out, my friend. Thank you for joining us tonight.
It's a pleasure.
Montreal, we'll be right back. Montreal, we're back, and we're here with a second of our wise men tonight. We're letting them give you an overview of the major stories in Canada the past week. David Harris, former Deputy Director of CSIS for Strategic Planning, welcome. Thanks for taking the time to be with us today.
Hey, Beryl. I should say I was Chief of Strategic Planning with CSIS.
You know, one day I'm going to get this right between Deputy Director of CSIS for Strategic Planning and Chief of Strategic Planning. Why can't you be both? But that's irrelevant.
Well, I appreciate the promotion, though.
David Harris, there's one thing about the Arar inquiry that concerns me. What is this going to do to our security apparatus? There's concern among friends of mine in the intelligence services of other countries that it's going to make the RCMP, surely, but perhaps CSIS, so careful that they will be frozen from doing anything even until it's vetted by so many levels that it'll become basically ineffective. Is that a possibility?
I think this is a real issue. I mean, we've seen it around and about as a matter that in some ways got us to 9/11 in the first place. You well remember in the 1970s you had the U.S. Church Committee, Frank Church running that committee,
yes,
investigating illicit activities undertaken by the CIA and other intelligence arms. And that was the very thing that left us with the legacy of the artificial walls between, for example, the domestic intelligence and foreign intelligence sides of things, which, if they had come together before 9/11, might well have been able to have headed off that disaster. So there is, yes, a real concern, Beryl, that you could find intelligence services compartmentalized or just plain paralyzed by a concern about doing the wrong thing and having staff members wind up with career-killing appearances before inquiries and all kinds of other investigations.
I'm glad you brought up the church hearings, because many of our listeners don't know what one of the results of the church hearings was. And Frank Church was a great senator, but many progressives today, and many people on the left who disagree with both the invasion of Iraq and even of Afghanistan, say, look, we didn't need the army in there. Let's just send in some selective squads to take care of these renegade leaders. Except the church hearings, and you'll correct me on the number of this executive order, directly led to executive order, if I believe it was 1340, that disallowed any political assassination on the part of the CIA. And every time they try to reverse that executive order, Congress vetoes it. So that had a direct effect on where we are today in the options available on rogue states.
Well, that's very true, and indeed, if you really go into the executive order history, you find that there were several that imposed this, including, I think, one at least under President Reagan, who was not necessarily known for his more restrained approach.
No, certainly not.
And you recall as well that dramatic bit of footage that showed Clinton recently claiming that he'd made all sorts of efforts to get bin Laden in the days before 9/11. Somebody correctly raised the point that was one of the few occasions when a former U.S. president had actually been screaming his guilt or near guilt of breaching U.S. law because of that assassination bar or proscription.
Right.
So it's a really tricky kind of issue. And, you know, one of the things we have to remember is that we may want to move in the right direction, but the farther we move in any single direction, the more we might be inhibiting our own ability to defend ourselves at a pretty basic level.
Now, talking about our ability to defend ourselves and talking to friends of mine at CSIS, and I know they're friends of yours, they said quite openly, look, the only reason this went to the RCMP is we don't have enough field agents. Now, when is that message going to get through to the government? We can't run a security service with only about 1,500 field agents and probably twice as many analysts and expect screw-ups not to happen. But in this case, not just a screw-up, but things that could have cost a man his life.
Well, you might remember a senior representative of the RCMP, and I guess a few months ago, made the point that really, not by any means all reasonable targets when it comes to organized crime, and one might even guess intelligence and terrorism-related targets, can be pursued by the RCMP because they are short of resources. This leaves us with a real challenge.
By CSIS that are short of resources.
Well, that's right. I mean, the nature of the work now required, especially after 9/11, the overtime and the grinding effect on resources, on people, is not to be underestimated, and there's always a risk in the very best of organizations that you could have sloppiness or oversights or other things that could develop and could result in disasters because people are, again, overconsumed. And that's not something that people are really used to coming to grips with. We've tended to assume that where there's an organization, you've had the mandate effectively covered.
And, of course, we know it's dangerous to assume because you make an asset of you and me. David Harris, please stay with us. We're going to take a short break. Montreal, we're back. We're talking with David Harris, former chief of strategic planning for CSIS, on the Arar inquiry and the results that could be facing and the possible dangers not only to citizens but also to the effectiveness of our security apparatus. David, one thing that was known in the Arar case, that in 2003 the evidence was pretty solid that there was a relationship between him and training that he had received from groups affiliated to Al-Qaeda. Now, what bothers me is not, it's obviously that the guy was shipped off to Syria. What bothers me is what happened at Kennedy Airport. This guy comes back from Tunisia. We're supposed to have such an intimate relationship with American security services. If there's a threat, why wasn't Canada notified immediately? And why didn't Canada insist bring him back here? We'll put him on trial and we'll investigate. Because this is the fourth case of a Canadian-Syrian citizen, a Syrian-Canadian citizen, shipped off to Syria, including one, of course, or shipped off or picked up in Syria, one of which we actually took on at the Institute, that of Abdullah al-Malki, who just came to Syria to visit and was sent into a Syrian torture cell for a year. Where did that break down? Why can't we pick up the phone and say, hey, you know, he's ours, we'll take care of it?
I just don't know the answer to that, and of course, a good deal of what's emerged, even after all the work of the inquiry, the commission, is secret.
I can't find that answer in all these pages. I was wondering if you could.
No, well, no, although, again, there is so much that who knows what could turn up with a further review of all the material. But, again, there's a fair amount that is we're not privy to, and also, of course, the U.S. authorities did not really participate in the commission consideration and investigation. So that has led to at least one individual, a former RCMP person, who has suggested that there might yet be material that the FBI or other American organizations might have that might suggest that there was more justification for the U.S. interest in Mr. Arar than is immediately obvious.
I have heard that from multiple sources, and of course Gary Clement, who was the former head of Project AO, which was the group that was initially investigating these suspects, who is now chief of police at Cobourg, Ontario, who released a 1,300-word statement the day of the O'Connor inquiry saying, hey, look, everything was done right, and then apparently we tried to get him on the show. Apparently he was told, you know, he said, I'm not saying anymore.
That's right. He was certainly the most prominent of those saying this sort of thing, and I don't know what the detailed justification was for his observations. It's certainly going to be true that the Americans will have some material on a wide variety of subjects, not necessarily relating to Arar, and certainly not suggesting guilt on his part, that we won't be privy to, and that's part of the frustration. But we also, as you've said, have to be realistic about how it is that we might expect to have access to too much secret information when we're facing an enemy who is trying to kill us. Let's face it.
Yeah, and I get this real queasy feeling in the pit of my stomach, as you know, about Canada's tradition of having one-person commissions of inquiry that often have orders or a preconceived agenda where they know suggestions have been made about where the results should go.
Yeah.
And evidence, certain evidence is included, certain evidence is excluded for no apparent reason. So it makes me kind of queasy on that end.
You know, that's far from unreasonable, because
we've got an indictment of an entire security establishment who, when they were given, we don't need intercepts on our internet telephony. We don't need wiretaps without warrants. The Toronto 17 was blown apart by good, solid security fieldwork.
Well,
and something like O'Connor could really hamstring a government that wants to give more assets on the ground.
And there were some things that were troubling that nobody seems to have mentioned about this commission. As you know, there was a group of about 18 intervener organizations.
Yes.
These were organizations that were permitted by the commissioner to make representations, to be given special or partial standing before the commission. And that accords a fair amount of privilege. It's a distinction. It gives credibility. And I'm familiar with a handful of the organizations that got that status, and I believe virtually all, maybe all of the organizations given that status were very much inclined to anti-government positions and certainly no friends of security and intelligence. And, you know, in the case of one of them, one of the organizations is a defendant in a 9/11 lawsuit, for Pete's sakes. Another gave a Media Excellence Award to the founder of a Canadian Islamic newspaper that takes the position that 9/11 was a success and that we should have the spread of Iranian-type theocracy around the world. And two others were supporters of the continued legal existence in Canada, if you can imagine, of Hamas and/or Hezbollah, and don't appear to have changed their positions even after it's been demonstrated that Hezbollah has done targeting reconnaissance in Canada against Canadians. So I have no idea, you know, what kind of influence those organizations, among others, might have exerted on proceedings. Certainly, some of their representatives were, as far as I know, allowed to ask questions of government officials, and, as I say, more to the point, gain credibility through their presence before the commission.
Well, David, I don't think this we've heard the last of this, and I have one last quick question, because we're fighting the clock a bit, but I want to get your views on this, and it's a bit out of the security area, it's in the diplomatic area. Whatever somebody may have done or not done, what bothers me is the lack of Canadian sovereignty. For me, Canadian sovereignty is over our citizens and the ability to protect them, like the Samson case in Saudi Arabia, and to get them back is more important than planting flags in the Arctic. And are we ever going to get to the point where our foreign affairs people really can go into prisons in Syria and Saudi Arabia and really offer protection to our citizens? I have a feeling that our security apparatus will be fixed faster than our foreign affairs diplomatic apparatus.
Well, it's a real problem, isn't it? Because you've got competing sovereignties. As you well know, if you've got somebody in another country, they're going to be subject to that jurisdiction. And if that person in the other country has that foreign country's citizenship, as, for example, Mr. Arar did or had had at one time, then it can be very, very sticky. So this is a genuinely global kind of problem all countries face.
David Harris, many thanks for your time.
Thanks, Beryl.
Montreal, we'll be right back. Montreal, we're back. And as I said, this is the evening of the three wise men, and one of the wisest in the country is Raymond Hurd, former editor of the Montreal Star, head of CanWest News. Ray, thanks for joining us from Toronto. You've become quite a regular here, and I'm happy for it.
Okay, well, I'm glad to be back with you.
We've discussed a lot of the big-ticket items in the papers tonight, from the Arar inquiry to the Liberal leadership race, but I want to discuss with you something that you brought to my attention, and Montrealers particularly need to know that, and Quebecers need to know it because we're so bloody provincial-centric. We've got a mayoralty election going on in Toronto where almost a third of Canadians vote, and it's going to have repercussions for where we go. Could you just describe the candidates, the issues, and when the dates are?
Firstly, let me say this. This will be the single biggest vote in Canada. A lot of people are eligible to vote. Turnouts are low. Having said that, the mayor for the last 3 years has been a totally inept socialist called David Miller, who looks nice on television.
Now, Ray, let's call him a progressive.
No, he's a socialist. He's an NDPer. He's a stalking horse for Jack Layton. And he has been
a modest little person with much to be modest about, as Churchill said of Clement.
Yeah, actually, he's quite a big guy. He's a rugby player. Maybe he should stay in the rugby scrum because his his performance so far has been no one knows. If you travel in this city, which you think Montreal has problems, you know, this city doesn't even register anymore on the list of places people want to go to. The Americans are not coming. It has real problems. David Miller has done exactly nothing for 3 years except stop a bridge to the Island Airport. That airport would connect this city by turbojets made in Toronto with 17 other North American cities. Now, the other contender, there are two others. One will be known to your listeners. That's Stephen LeDrew, the bow-tied, horn-rimmed spectacle, former president of the Liberal Party. I'm sure you know Stephen.
Yes.
I don't think he has much of a chance, but he's a nice guy. His biggest problem is that he's bankrupt, legally bankrupt, so people are saying, well,
I just heard that the other night. Last time I had dinner with Stephen was a few years ago in Ottawa at the market. I just heard that last night.
Yeah, well, I mean,
or the other day,
it's sad, but people are not inclined to vote for a guy who can't manage his own finances. Also, and you'd appreciate this, when he announced he was running at the last minute last week, he said he didn't pay his taxes in order to send his daughters to the most exclusive private school in town. Now, that does not rub well, except in Rosedale, and Rosedale, as you know, is the equivalent of Westmount.
Right.
The other candidate, Jane Pitfield, who is related, I understand, to Michael Pitfield, who lives in Westmount and
former
was the
chief of the clerk of the Privy Council.
Jane Pitfield is a bit starchy. She's been a councillor for several years. It's obviously going to be a race between her and David Miller. Some of the smarter right of center liberals in town are backing her belatedly, including Senator Jeremiah Grafstein and Marty Goldfarb, who was the both of whom were Trudeau maybe we'll call him hatchet man.
Well, Grafstein was more with Turner, but Goldfarb was Trudeau's pollster.
Yeah, but Grafstein worked in Turner's office, though. He was originally with John Turner,
right.
But he was also very involved with Trudeau. So this is what's happening, and the real issue is that while Calgary and Vancouver move ahead, while Montreal, even though people are always wailing in Montreal, looks okay, Toronto is in decline, and the reason it's in decline is the voters, those who turned out, voted for a card-carrying socialist who has done nothing except, by the way, pay off the municipal unions.
And who's the engine that can get Toronto moving again, which is
the
post office address for Canadian business?
Would do a good job if he can overcome this disability of being bankrupt. Jane Pitfield is steady. She has a good team behind her. The big issue here, garbage and crime. We have a crime rate that is alarming. Montreal has bad one, but it seems to be, you know, the Dawson College thing was terrible. But thank God only one person died. Here we've had a lot of violence, gang violence.
Right.
Miller has done nothing about that. So why is it important? The future of North America, Beryl, is the future of city-states.
Correct. And certainly the future of Canada is the future of the city with the post office address for business.
Yeah. And by the way, you know, it sounds arrogant. Toronto thinks it's the center of the universe. It isn't anymore. Do you know that fewer Americans are coming here to spend their money than in 1978? So we need a new mayor. David Miller has, as we expect, a secret alliance with Jack Layton. And you know something about the socialists. Newspapers don't have the guts to really dig here. They play dirty tricks in elections like you won't believe.
Yeah, but Jack Layton, you know, as somebody once said, is simply a shiver looking for a spine to run up.
Yeah.
When's the date of the election?
It's in November. It's going to be an epic race, and it will boil down to the turnout. I think Pitfield, whose advantages is she's a woman. Now, actually, David Miller reminds women of their first husband. So that's one of the big problems he has. I think it's also, not going too far, but I think there's a big scandal brewing in the city. Washington has a scandal about page boys, as you may have noticed.
Yep.
I think there's a big scandal brewing, but it's dangerous to say more than that, except to whet your appetite in case it breaks.
Raymond Hurd, we thank you for your time tonight. We're going to be checking with you before the election again, and we hope that Toronto gets a mayor who's got the attention span
and
of something, longer than a lightning bolt.
I'm checking out.
What?
I'm checking out if Miller wins again.
You're not checking out. We're going to keep you there, and there's going to be somebody there with an attention span longer than a lightning bolt. Raymond Hurd,
okay.
Thank you very much. Montreal, we'll be back with you tomorrow night.